It's probably a rare person who moves from working in the intelligence business to teaching meditation, but our guest this hour did just that. Larry Wardwell lives in the Ashland area now, but he's traveled a bunch of miles to get here. His progression from Air Force guy to college guy to intelligence operative to LSD user and beyond is told in his book, Confessions of a Closet Yogi. Larry joins us in the studio. Thanks for joining us, Larry Wardwell.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So safe to say you've been open to just about anything through your life?
Yeah, unfortunately I have.
It's done you well, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well.
So one thing to consider your life or meditate upon it, what made you write a big memoir? This is not a small book.
Yeah, you know, as I got older, I thought how grateful I was to meditation. I thought maybe I'll write a book about how meditation influenced my life. And it kind of expanded into this huge memoir, which was kind of fun. I enjoyed writing it. I even enjoy reading it.
You admit in the first sentence that confessions might not be appropriate.
Why not? Well, I think that I'm not, you know, you look at me and I'm just a regular guy. I'm not like a yogi guy. But I meditate twice a day and I love it. And I'm into you know, that silence of meditation. And it's not something that people would talk to you about. And it's sort of like a secret or something like that. And so I figured, well, that's a catchy title, which it didn't work out to be so catchy. But anyway, that's another story.
Well, it's got Confessions of a Closet Yogi. I mean, it sounds pretty interesting. The idea that people don't necessarily talk about this stuff. I mean, when you tell people you meditate, are they surprised? Given particularly that you are a regular guy.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, it's something in everyday conversation with your average person, they don't care about that. Most people aren't interested in that sort of stuff. So you don't talk about it. You know, just enjoy it and live it. So.
Let's hit a few highlights first. Why did you go into the Air Force?
You know, I was a 17-year-old kid, and it's 1958. There are no jobs, no wars, and I didn't want to go to college at the time. I'd graduated from high school, and I thought, I really want some adventure to see the world. And so I joined the Air Force because I thought that would be more fun than sleeping in tents in the Army. I mean, that's the extent of my awareness of life at 17 years old. So I just, for a kid, you know, I just thought it would be a fun thing to do.
And working through the highlights here, so what you, at college after that, and then why international relations as a course of study?
You know, I was always interested in international politics and international relations, just something I'm sort of a political junkie, and I was very interested in international things, and I just thought that would be an interesting subject.
Did you expect to go into intelligence, though?
No, actually, I was more interested in NGO work and Peace Corps and the State Department and things like that. But I sort of got recruited into intelligence work, and I thought, I'll get to Washington, have a job there at least, and I'll be able to look for something else. And that's how I ended up doing that.
Seems like a fairly button-down job, like, you know, sit at a desk, take regular lunch breaks, wear a tie, that sort of thing. So how did you end up in Timothy Leary's orbit?
You know, it's really an amazing story because I had been interested in expansion of consciousness. I went to a lecture in D.C. at the Georgetown Chamber of Commerce, and this woman was an advocate of LSD. And at the time, it was legal. And she really inspired me because I was interested in more than just what met the eye, you know, the inner depth of life. And so the next day, I was going to lunch with this young, straight-arrow naval officer. And we're going to the officers' club, and it's a secure intelligence environment and all that sort of stuff. And I just was so inspired by this, I thought I would take a chance and mention to him that I went to this LSD lecture. And so I kind of look around my shoulders and so forth. I see there's no one else around. We're walking on the campus, so to speak. And I said, you know, I went to this great lecture in LSD last night, and I'm really inspired and intrigued by this. And so then he looks around and he says, you know, Commander so-and-so and myself, we're really good friends with Timothy Leary, and we go up occasionally up to Millbrook maybe once a month and take LSD with him. Do you want to come? And I said, yeah, just right away. I just said, yeah, and that's how it started.
I just laugh at this part of it, though, because, I mean, there are some things that can only happen at certain points in history, and you were there at the time when you could learn about LSD from the Georgetown Junior Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, things were definitely different then.
So, from into Timothy Leary's orbit at this place up in Millbrook, is that where Zoshram
was? Millbrook, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did one experience pretty much lead to another from that point forward?
Yeah, it was very interesting because that's sort of opened my mind, expanded my mind, whatever you want to call it. And the counterculture was flourishing then. And people were turning on, tuning in, dropping out. And here I was stuck in this stultifying office job in Washington, D.C. And people were, you know, enjoying the outdoors and nature and that sort of thing. And also, there was, you know, politically it was very active at that time, too. And so I my wife and I decided to drop out of our government jobs and go out to the counterculture in Berkeley and San Francisco at that time. And so that led to some very interesting further developments in our growth or evolution.
Which we'll get to in a little further detail down the road here. But when you talk about, I mean, again, there's a lot of detail in the book. And as you admitted in the opening, you know, some things might have gotten a little out of time order. That sort of thing. Then there's this line, the most bizarre events are the most accurately described.
Yeah, that's really true. And some of the things, like back in the past in military, I might have made some composite characters and things like that. But the weirdest things were actually the most accurate in that book. So,
give an example.
Well, some of them are – my wife calls the first part of the book disgusting. There's a lot of really crazy things that I did. And those are really accurate.
Generally involving beer, cars, and
yeah, and all that
police,
kind of stuff. Yeah, those were really accurate. And I don't want to take up too much time describing those things because my wife is listening. She doesn't like that stuff. So anyway, but I don't know how much detail you want me to go into in some of those things. I mean,
well,
a couple
minutes. We'll have to get to that after break if you're going to wind up into a big stem winder here. So,
yeah, okay, whatever.
So we'll take a short break here. The book is called Confessions of a Closet Yogi. It's about Larry Wardwell's life. He's a little hard to categorize. He served in the Air Force, worked in the Defense Intelligence Agency, got a degree in international relations, learned meditation, and taught it for nearly 20 years. And he's also very interested in botanical medicine. So we'll get into some of the lives and loves of Larry Wardwell as we continue talking about his book, Confessions of a Closet Yogi. Later in the hour, we'll meet makers of mead in the Corvallis area, the folks from Nectar Creek. You'll learn about what they've added to a very old beverage. That's all coming up in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. Your phone calls and emails are welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange at a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking to Larry Wardwell, an Ashland area resident, about a very interesting life. He went from high school to the Air Force, from the Air Force to college, from college to the intelligence industry, working for the DIA, switched letters and went from DIA to LSD, and things get really interesting from there. His book is called Confessions of a Closet Yogi. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So the first episode that you describe at length in the book is you get caught in a spring snowstorm in Arizona as an adult with wife and son. Your body stayed. Where'd your mind go?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because we had gone out we're in the Chiricahua National Monument, and we did a lot of hiking, a lot of traveling in the Southwest in the wintertime. And we went on this, what we thought was going to be a day hike, and up into to the higher elevations. And as we started hiking up this canyon, my son said, he was about 8 or 9 years old at the time. He said, hey, Dad, you know, we better bring some matches. And I said, I don't want to walk all the way back to the camper. And he insisted. So we got some matches and we got our hats and mittens. I don't know why he insisted on that. So I'm walking up this canyon, and I had a kind of sensation or feeling that I'd been there before, and that maybe I was in the cavalry, and I chased, because the history of this canyon is where the Indians used to run up and hide in this canyon. They used to draw the cavalry in and massacre them and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so there was a strange feeling, I thought. Maybe it was my imagination. I don't know. So anyway, we get up to the top of the mountain. We get lost, and we can't find a way down, and it's getting dark. And we look to find different ways down the mountain. All over were these waterfall tight drop-offs, and we couldn't actually get down. So we had to spend the night, and if we didn't have the matches to start a fire, we would have been in real trouble. So I lit a fire, and we're trying to keep warm, and it turns into a blizzard, which we weren't expecting. So I kept turning myself around, trying to melt the ice off my jacket and get close to the fire. And we built a little lean-to when my wife and son stayed. And I kind of eventually fell into some kind of meditative dream state. And then I had this kind of very expansive cosmic experience out of that. And so from there, I thought, well, this would be a good way to start the book, going from there into a flashback kind of situation.
Well, cosmic experience, but what you saw was a mountain of beer cans, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Which kind of describes your high school years.
Yeah, the cosmic experience is the blinding light and so forth. Uh-huh. But this was the blinding light of about 100,000 beer cans glinting in the sunlight. And it brought me back to that experience of stealing the beer from the town dump, which was another story.
Because the manufacturer of beer would fail to punch the holes in the cans to destroy them.
So one out of every 20 or 30 cans was good free beer, and there were flies and buzzing all around. It was really a disgusting experience, but it was free beer.
Yeah. So I don't know. Your high school years in the late 50s really sound like something out of Happy Days, the old TV show. I mean,
yeah.
Was it something like that?
Yeah, it was that real 50s environment.
So how did a guy like you, clearly out for a good time and more than a few beers, how did you mesh with the military when you were in the Air Force?
You know, that was I might call a game changer or eye opener for me, because I didn't realize what I was getting into. And the first thing I got stuck doing was guarding airplanes in South Dakota in the wintertime all by yourself, standing out there 8 hours a day with this frozen gun, and you're standing there and you're alone, a little 17-year-old kid with, you got two hydrogen bombs in this big 52, and you're there all by yourself with these two hydrogen bombs. You're looking at them. You don't know what they look like, garbage cans or something like that. And you're supposed to protect that airplane from anybody that might want to do something bad to it. And it's a totally useless exercise. That's what it was, in my opinion. So I sort of realized that I had to get out of the military, and I started going to college and taking classes.
But before that, though, I mean, you did get a chance to go overseas. You got sent to Germany in 1961, which is a very interesting year to be in
Germany.
Very
good, yeah. And so that was great, because I thought I was doomed to being guarding airplanes out in South Dakota, and some bureaucratic fluke, which shouldn't have happened. I ended up spending a nice year and a half in Germany, and I ended up being out of the military, off the base, working with the German police, who might have been kind of happy-go-lucky ex-Gestapo guys. I don't know who they were, but they were fun to work with. And I had sort of an expat life at that time. Learned the language and lived with the Germans and had a great time. So that was good.
Larry Wardwell, as you can tell, is a bit of a storyteller. He tells very many in his memoir, Confessions of a Closet Yogi. Were you in any way worldly before you got assigned to Europe, would you say?
Yeah. You know, by that time I was 20 years old. You know, I've been around with a lot of military-type people and that kind of lifestyle, you might call it.
So the studies aside, I mean, you went you came back to the United States out of the Air Force, went to college in Texas to study journalism. Studies aside, it seems like you were still partying like it was 1959.
Yeah, we were. You know, I was thinking about that. And our sort of the guys that I lived with were older. They had been in the military with me. And the guys that I lived with were hellraisers still, even when we went to college. And so our studies sort of suffered as a result of that, you might say. And we did a lot of crazy stunts when we were in college, too. And our role models at that time were the Rat Pack, you know, Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. drinking and raising hell and that sort of thing. So that's sort of what happened to my college education. It wasn't the best that could have happened, I guess.
Let's get an example of the drinking and raising hell, because there's one incident in particular. We're actually just talking about this during the break. But so you guys decided to do a little test driving of motorboats. Was this just after high school, was it?
Yeah, I was in the military, and I was home on leave, and I was probably about 18 by that time. And the sort of the cultural activities of those times meant you loaded up a car and drove down to the end of Cape Cod, and you loaded up the car with beer, and then you drove as far as you could and just drove into the sand dunes and passed out and drank beer and raised hell. And so about halfway down, the driver was so intoxicated, he said, "I can't drive anymore." We pulled off of this little town in Brewster, right on the ocean. There was a nice little harbor there. And most of the guys passed out. And a friend of mine and myself walked down to the beach. It was a beautiful full moon evening night, and we looked out over the water, and there was a little boat pulled up on the side of the beach there. We went out for a little row, and we thought, gee, it'd really be nice to experience this harbor in more detail by driving around. So we found a boat and we started it up and we ran out of gas and got another boat. So we switched all these boats on different moorings. And finally, all the lights started going on around the harbor, and there's a searchlight looking for us, and it's the police saying, give up, you know, come in, and so forth. And we thought, oh, what are we going to do? So we finally tied up all the last boat, and we thought, well, maybe we can sneak away from this. But we didn't have any shoes on. We're running around. It's getting dawn. And we finally realized we should give ourselves up. So the police chief at the time was a nice guy. He took us in, and he said, I'm going to take all your beer away, and I'm going to let you guys go, but I never, ever want to see you in this town again. You're banned from this town for life. And so then there were some subsequent legal actions that took place after that, but we kind of sort of escaped that situation.
To this day, have you set foot in Brewster, Massachusetts again?
Not during the daytime.
That's a good idea. So in your travels here, you decided to, we talked about going to college in Texas, and then you shifted. You went to Ohio State University, is that right?
Yeah, right.
Which is a good thing. So where did you meet your future wife?
That's another interesting story. I left Texas because we turned our apartment into a bar room, and at that time beer was illegal in Texas. So the problem was that people would come knocking on the door at 2 or 3 in the morning and everything, it would really ruin your academic life. And so my buddies graduated, so I thought I'll go back to Ohio where my parents lived and go to Ohio State. And so after a year or so at Ohio State, my roommate said, hey, I have to go to New York for a wedding, and I'm the best man, and you want to come, we'll have some fun this weekend. And so I said, yeah, sure. And so at that time, students could go half price on airlines, and so we were waiting in line. There were about 50 students in line. There was a big blizzard, and I was number 47, and my buddy was 48, and Linnea was number 49. And so my number was called out. I got on, went to get on the airplane. Then I realized my buddy had to be there because he had to be at the wedding rehearsal that night. So at the last minute, and you could do that in those days, I jumped off the plane and I ran back. I said, hey, Wesley, you better get on the plane now. So I was stuck with Linnea. And it was my birthday and we celebrated. And I was so infatuated with her that, you know, it just turned out to be a great love story. We've been married for 50 years and it's great.
Congratulations. Yeah. Larry Wardwell's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His memoir is Confessions of a Closet Yogi. It's been a life that led him from high school to the Air Force to college to working in the intelligence business to taking up LSD and moving into higher consciousness and teaching meditation for nearly 20 years. Really interesting story. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So on campus was when you had your interviews with the intelligence agencies. Give us a sense of what they were asking of you.
You know, that was interesting because I was looking for a job, and they had all these recruiters, and I didn't want to work for IBM or one of these other companies, and I did want to work for the government. And I had taken the State Department exam, and I failed it in American history, and I thought, well, I'll go and study up in American history, and I can maybe take it again. And that was my goal, sort of to be in the State Department. So in the meantime, I'm thinking it'd be really nice to get to Washington, D.C., and so I interview with the CIA, and this guy he made me sign all these secret things and all this stuff not to reveal that I had an interview with him. And he was really uptight. And when he looked at my grades, he said, I don't think you have your grades aren't good enough to be an analyst. But, you know, you'd really be good as an operative in Southeast Asia. You know, you got military experience, you know, weapons and all that sort of stuff. And I said, I don't want to do that. And he kept trying to talk me into that. And I said, no, I want to be an analyst. So he said, okay, you got to take this test in this clandestine place. And it's a psychological test. So I took the test, and I never heard from them again. So then I went to the DIA recruiter, and he was avuncular. He was happy-go-lucky, and he showed me all the plans and all the whole DIA worked and everything like that. He was just a fun guy, and I thought, well, I'll apply there. And then I got hired by them, and that's how I ended up doing that work.
And here again, this is when you're working in Washington, D.C., and Linnea came down for a summer, and you got to know her a lot better, and things moved closer. But I just love the fact that you learned about LSD from the Georgetown Junior Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, I know. That was,
and then a guy who worked at the DIA with you was
yeah,
the one that, who
that's
led you
what is so amazing.
Timothy Leary.
Two military guys.
So
yeah.
Did meditation come in the package with acid? I mean, through the same people, basically?
Well, you know what? We found out we were always – as a matter of fact, we were because one of the friends that we had was a real proponent of LSD, but he also – was a yogi. He was the disciple of Swami Yogananda, and he taught spiritual stuff at this church in Washington, D.C. But then he started getting more excited about LSD than the spiritual things, and his master kind of exiled him. Anyway, we went out to Berkeley, California, and that's how we found out about meditation.
So you did the full counterculture late 60s experience.
Oh, yeah, and then we got disillusioned with it, which is very interesting, too.
Disillusioned how?
Well, you know, what we found is that we... LSD and these things were more like not a spiritual sacrament, but something you took to put you more in tune with nature and out of that kind of uptight rat race kind of world. And so what we found in California, that it was a recreational drug. People were just getting stoned on LSD and raising hell, and it was not a real spiritual movement. And then we went to Altamont, that big festival with the Rolling Stones, and was sort of supposed to be the West Coast Woodstock.
50 years ago, just a couple days ago.
I guess it was, yeah. And that really turned us off. And that's when who were those guys? The Hells Angels murdered somebody on the stage. And it was just a weird feeling there. And so, as a matter of fact, we parked our car about 2 miles away so we could escape in case it was crazy. So that was really kind of like the end of, for us, the end of that part of the counterculture, and we were getting into meditation. We thought that was a better route for us than doing the drugs and things.
Talk about your exposure to the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who, you know, as you point out, there was more to him than just the fact that the Beatles hung out with him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, there are different. You know, sometimes people call meditation a cult and all these different things. My experience was that he was probably the most selfless, compassionate person I ever met, and he was just very full of love and kindness. And that was our experience. We had a few personal experiences with him, which are really kind of inspiring. So that was our experience with him. And so we taught meditation for 20 years. After a while, the TM movement got a little bit more hierarchical than we were used to. And we had a 2-year-old, a noisy kid that didn't fit too much in a meditation center. So we kind of stopped actively teaching, I guess you'd say.
I'm struck by the number of things that happen to you that just don't seem like they're possible in the world anymore. I mean, for one thing, being in the Bay Area counterculture, which is gone now, learning about LSD for the Georgetown Junior Chamber of Commerce, and you bought a house in the Oakland Hills for how much?
$7,000. And that had a view of all of the San Francisco Bay, and it's up in the Oakland Hills, and it was kind of a transition neighborhood. There was like a lot of black people and white people mixed in there and everything, and we finally were able to unload that for $7,500. And, you know, it's some people in real estate call it the we should have, you know, maybe we should have hung on to it or something like that, but, you know, that's history, you know, you can't really.
But you bought it for $7,000 and sold it for
$7,500.
Wow, that is a real estate story that is it's ancient history.
Yeah, ancient history.
Do you know if that house actually is still there, if it survived the Oakland fire?
I would imagine it's been torn down and somebody put a trophy house there, but probably. I haven't been back there.
Talk about some of the places you've been on the planet, and for that matter, been inside yourself in search of higher understanding and getting to a point where you could teach meditation.
Well, you know, what was really great is that we were able to go on what they call these long meditation courses or retreats, and we would meditate for 6 months at a time up in the mountains in Switzerland. And there's, you know, it's a beautiful environment for meditation, and so you're just sort of sunk into this state of silence for 6 months. And it was a great experience to be in that much silence for that long a period of time. I think I don't know if it's transformational, but it was really a very valuable experience, I guess you might say.
What's it like when you come back to the world and talk to people again and re-enter that as it is?
Well, you know, you kind of call it coming down from meditation. You gradually get reintegrated into the world, you know, going out and driving cars and things like that. So you gradually get reintegrated, but you're so steeped in that inner silence that it's a very blissful experience to be out in the world at that time. It's really great. And then after you do that a lot, then you kind of maintain that inner state of happiness. And so it works for me.
And where did you work with the Maharishi?
Where,
yeah.
Oh, taught TM, taught meditation?
Well, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out where in the world you've been to learn some of these things.
Well, mainly on the East Coast, you know, Virginia, Washington, D.C.
But not to India, is it?
Oh, yeah, we went to India. There was they had a great event in India. They had I don't know, about 10,000 people from all over the world in this big group of meditation. And the owner of the Indian Express newspaper was a friend of Maharishi's. And he says, you can use my building, which, you know, when somebody says that in India, you want to think twice. And so the building was half completed. There were 7,000 people there. There were two bathrooms for 7,000 people. I don't want to go into any more details than that. But it was quite an experience. So That was a very interesting experience, being crammed in with those 7,000 people meditating in this office building. And I found a place, I had to sleep in that building. I found a place to sleep with a buddy of mine. And it was, this building is being added to the existing building. And so we found this alcove, and we, my buddy and I woke up. And then in the morning, we could hear all these typewriters. Mm-hmm. And looked at, our window was actually joined to the office of another building. And so we're sleeping there. And we kind of wake up, and we're rubbing our eyes, and we look, and these Indians are waving at us, you know, and they're just working away, because to them, it's probably used to have people sleeping around on the floor or something like that. So that was another aspect of that.
Tell us about the place you sleep now, the place you built in the hills near Ashland.
Yeah, we love it up there. We live up in the Green Springs, up above Ashland, at about 4,000 feet. And when we came here, we were looking for some land to build a house. We always loved living in rural places, and we couldn't afford anything. We found these two lots of land that were kind of logged over and everything. And one day we went up there and finally saw the view of Mount Ashland. We loved it up there. And my son, myself, and a guy who knew what he was doing actually built a house over a winter, which wasn't the smartest idea. And we have a great, great little house with a great view of Mount Ashland, and love that life up there.
So many fun stories in the book, Confessions of a Closet Yogi. Larry Wardwell wrote it and has joined us on The Exchange today. You can find the book and more about Larry at closetyogi.com. Larry Wardwell, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Hey, great. It was great being here.
All right.
Thank
take
you.
Care.
Okay.